real life
superpowers.
And I remember marching into the Prime Minister's office of Hungary, saying I was sent by George Soros to scout for some acquisition targets. And the Prime Minister said, wait a minute, before you do that, I have a small request, please. Here's a one-pager, and this is our instructions for privatization. This is the new codex for privatization. What I'd like you to do before you mount on finding acquisitions is to develop the book of the law that would govern our privatization process. Sure enough, I've done that. And then I went into search for acquisition targets, came back to George Soros, and I said, here's the thing, and this is what you're supposed to do with it. And he said, oh, that's just fascinating work, Professor Menipaz. I don't have more time now. Could you join me? I'd like to take my limousine back to the airport now. Could you join me, please?
Hello and welcome to another episode of Real Life Superpowers, hosted by Noah Eshed and myself. Today we have the privilege of speaking with a truly remarkable guest, Professor Ehud Menipaz. For over 60 years, he has worked with the likes of George Soros, U.S. presidents, and others. He has been researching global entrepreneurship and written more than 4 books on global entrepreneurship. He is a professor for industrial engineering and global entrepreneurship in Columbia University and other institutions. And he's been an inspiration for me as well. Meet Professor Ehud Menipaz, my father.
Real life.
Superpowers. Superpowers.
So, hello there, Professor Ehud Menipaz. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Noah and Ronen.
I just want to say that the episode with your brother is our most listened one, with no pressure at all.
Well, there's no pressure. In Hebrew, there is a great saying that says, Adam lo mitkane berabo v'talmido, vaday lo bebno. So there's no jealousy, there's no competition here. I'm very happy that the kids are doing great. They should be a new and improved version of me.
So, Professor, not long ago, you went out with the research of global entrepreneurs, right?
Correct.
So tell me about that research a little bit.
Thank you for the question. About 25 years ago, Israel and 9 other countries decided to start off on a mission to check out on entrepreneurship and innovation, specifically to find out how do you define scientifically the ecosystem for innovation and entrepreneurship, and put together a worldwide comparison of these ecosystems across countries and across regions. The paradigm that was developed, and that was really something new, was such that in a very methodical, scientific way, the issue of innovation and entrepreneurship has been defined so that the results of this study, which is conducted annually and is sampling about 95% of the world economy and 70% of the world population, the results are such that nobody can argue with the significance of those results.
What are the results?
And the results are varied in many of them. The database now includes millions of data points, and they have to do with, as I said, the ecosystem that makes way for countries, nations, and regions to become innovative and become successful and contribute significantly to the local GDP or GNP, gross national product. I'll give you one insight, which I think is very interesting. As I said, there are many of them, but maybe one of them, which I think we can start off with. It turns out in many respects, independent entrepreneurs, such as you yourself are familiar with, contribute negatively in many nations to the increase of the local GDP. On the other hand, internal entrepreneurship, internal innovation, in other words, innovation that is coming as part of the day-to-day work of larger organizations that have deep pockets, contribute positively to the growth of local GDP or GNP, such as Mobileye. Mobileye is a great example whereby a fairly large company allowed itself to spend millions of dollars in order to develop some breakthrough innovative products, as opposed to independent entrepreneurs, which are good people, but many times they don't have the deep pockets required in order to eventually launch successfully a new product. And so they lose money on their own, they lose the family money, they lose maybe some of the government's programs monies in the process. So this is one of the many, many different insights, yes.
But I find that really interesting because there is an entire ecosystem around entrepreneurship, and it's always comprised, or many times it's comprised, of the VCs and of the investors. And then I assumed that although most fail, at the end of the day, they're balanced out with the success stories. So you're saying that's not true. And at the end of the day, this whole chart is basically distributed in a way that is negative.
As I said, it's very difficult to argue with the statistical significance of the results of the study. And I indicate to you that in many nations, the contribution to the growth of GDP is negative when we talk about independent, smaller entrepreneurship ventures. Yes.
Wow, that's
I know. Let me give you on some other insights, which are more exciting, I think, for many of us. You may or may not be familiar with my venture. Incidentally, I consider myself an entrepreneur as well. I'm an academic entrepreneur, a global entrepreneur, academic entrepreneur, because many of my ventures really have to do with the global economy. And I think that part of my history is indeed serving those bodies. Like, for example, the Economic Forum under the auspices of the president of Russia, or the forum under the auspices of the United States, office of the United States president, or the president of Mexico. And here's an interesting insight about gender. Several years back, I developed the national, now becomes an international hackathon, which is geared towards women in technology and engineering. And I found out through my international study that the female gender has to have, has to have some help, assistance, in three different dimensions in order to be successful. First, improving access to IP, intellectual property. Many times, females in technology and engineering do not have as much access to IP as their male counterparts. The Wow. second thing is, in a minute I'll talk about the reasons. The second thing is access to relevant social network. It so happens again that one of the findings of this global study is that indeed the female gender needs some help, assistance in this thing. And again, we can explain why possibly in a minute. And then access to capital. So between access to IP, access to relevant social network, and access to capital, we should do everything we can in order to help out. And indeed, the National Hackathon, which I founded 8 years ago, supposed to do just that. And that's why, incidentally, Cartier is one of my sponsors. Cartier, based in Paris, is a jewelry manufacturer and distributor, as you know, designer, manufacturer and distributor. And they said they don't want to deal with jewelry as much as they would like now to support women entrepreneurs in engineering and technology. And so they are the sponsors of the hackathon as well by now. Now, you asked me before, Noah, why there is less of an access to IP for the female gender. It's a good question. I'm not sure I have all the explanations for that. But I can tell you that in many countries, access to IP is a result of, on the one hand, research by independent researchers, and many times research by institutions like universities and research organizations like Rand Corporation in the United States and others, or the NSERC organization in Canada, that's the Natural Sciences and Research in Engineering Research Council in Canada. And you can say maybe because in chief executive positions there are predominant male executives, maybe that's the reason. But that's obviously a very tentative explanation. Bottom line is we have an opportunity here to do good in that sense. And the National Hackathon, which I founded, seems to do good in this way. And it's based on cooperation of many, many national and international universities that are involved in that.
Tell me, I have a question for you. So you called yourself a entrepreneur in the academics, right? So right. That itself is sort of like, you know, any entrepreneur hears that, it's kind of a paradox. Okay, because how can you be innovative in a place that there's so much bureaucracy and there's so much methods and, you know, and what if like in big corporations, like in academics, it should be a challenge to actually innovate. They actually should be scared to innovate. So like, how did you choose that pathway and how do you innovate in a place that is, you know, I don't want to say anti-innovation, but has a lot of fears and is a very heavy kind of corporation to make those changes. So how do you direct yourself in that kind of situation?
First, let me complete your question, your excellent question, because indeed academic institutions are very slow to change. They have many levels of approvals. Worse yet, as they say, you can tell an academic, but you cannot tell him or her much. In other words, each one of these individuals really consider themselves such experts that they are not ready to listen to any change, any advice, and they are afraid to learn something new because by that, they admit that they are no experts anymore, right? So your excellent question, let me just help out in here. Here's another oxymoron. You know, in the academic world, you go from a lecturer to a senior lecturer to an associate professor to a full professor. And the way you get this rank is on an individual achievement basis. If you discovered something, you get recognized and then you're being promoted, right? Well, guess what? All of us know, and you, Ronen, and Noah know it very well, that nobody can succeed by themselves. It's always a team effort. Well, there's an oxymoron for you. Everybody should work as a team, but eventually the recognition that the academic world gives is for the individual, say Professor Ehud Manipat, right? So there's an oxymoron. So there are many, many reasons why there is no innovation, credible innovation in the academic world.
But having said that, just because I know this, you have also done the Young Entrepreneurs globally. You have also done a hackathon, which universities haven't done a hackathon. You have also approved a gaming a degree, which is a new thing in Israel. You have also got sponsorships for global, you know, research and entrepreneur. Research and entrepreneur is not a classic kind of idea. It's not industrial engineering. So, okay. So having said that, okay, there is a hack. Like, how do you disrupt that?
Yeah. So disruption obviously is part of a definition of entrepreneurship. The classical economists always defined entrepreneurship as destructive innovation, because you got to destroy something in order to make it anew. This is the classics. And so the question is, how do you get to the point where indeed systems that are not ready to change do change? And I'm not sure whether I can give you all the essential elements, but I think maybe I can give you some pointers. The first thing, try to come up with ideas in academia that become so important for the society at large that the academia cannot disregard it. I'll give you an example. One of the institutions here, I was challenged to come up with a graduate degree in. And there are many graduate degrees, and in order to really make a change, you have to come up with something unique. Well, guess what? Several years back, I've come up with an idea to offer a graduate degree, listen to that, in immigration and social integration. Guess what? There are very few programs around the world, if any, on immigration and social integration. But as you can see around the world, the issue of immigration becomes a major issue. And social integration of those immigrants become a major issue. So I've defined this new program, and I've made it such an important issue because, as it so happened, in some countries, like, for example, Canada, immigration is a major issue. In Europe these days, immigration becomes a major issue. Well, once the community at large recognizes that as an issue, it's easier for me to offer this kind of a change within academia. And guess what? Just as an interesting anecdote, once I've introduced this new graduate program, 2-3 years down the road, I got a phone call from the Minister of Immigration of the Government of Canada. And he said, could we please come to your country? I happen to be based in Israel. He said, could we please come to Israel with my staff and to learn anything you can teach me about immigration and social integration? And soon enough, the Minister of Immigration of Canada flew in with a team, and they spent a whole day with me just trying to understand what is the most important thing that you need to do with immigrants when they land in your country. And guess what I told him? I told him that the most important thing for new immigrants to a country is not to teach them a profession, and it's not to give them a housing, provide them with housing, not to provide them with food, not to put them in schools necessarily. However, you need to teach them the language. Language is the essential element. Forget professions right now. Forget housing. That's right. Assimilation starts with speaking the local language. And I can tell you that I've been an immigrant possibly 3 times in my life. And I found that indeed the local language is so very important for you to basically sustain yourself. And if you are good enough, be successful. Language is a major issue. Well, the staff of the Minister of Immigration from Canada made a note of it because, as you know, in Canada, a large portion of the population is speaking French and large population speaks English. But those immigrants that come in not necessarily speak French or English. And obviously, giving them these language abilities is very important. I have to give good credits to Israel, my native country, for that. As you know, the immigrants, new immigrants that come to Israel, what is the first thing they enroll in? Ulpan, which is basically a language school. You learn the language, you become assimilated, you find work, et cetera, et cetera. But we digress for a second. I'm sorry, we possibly digress a little bit from the discussion. So please go ahead.
But it's very interesting because I think the key takeaway here is that you have to be with an entrepreneurial mindset if you want to innovate within academia, because if you're able to tap into an agenda or newsjack in a sense, and then, for example, that minister, the Canadian minister, basically there's an issue that he wants to solve and he needs academic validation probably in order to promote his own agendas. So if you are able to sort of keep your ear on the ground as an academic and be able to tap into those issues that will have another person on the other end who will be promoting this, then you're able to sort of hack the system.
It's funny because I actually hear something like that and a little more because it's funny because something about the academics also, like, you know, how it's sort of like boxed, right? And what you're talking about, Ehud, is sort of about creative thinking inside of those boxes, right? Which isn't very trivial, right? So you know what? Like, I have a question. Did you always want to be a professor? Like, how did you get to being a professor?
What a great question. You asked me very good questions. Thank you very much.
Okay, it's your only objective, by the way.
Yeah, you taught him well.
Here's the point. This is very interesting. A professor is just a titan. I'm going to blame your mother for that, if I may, Onen. Age 16 or so, I'm sitting in a car. At the time, there was a car, a very well-known car called Studebaker Lark, colored white. The seats were colored blue, I believe. And your mother asked me, Udi, what would you like to be when you grow up? I said, I'm really not completely sure, but I certainly would like to make a difference in the world. And I have to tell you that there are different ways to make a difference in the world, as you know very well. But I found out through the years that one way is become a professor. Why? Because, you know, if you're a medical doctor, somebody comes in with, I'm just saying, with a flu, you give him some antibiotics or you give him some other medicine and you send him home and he maybe become healthy and that's great. But that's short term. If you're a professor, and I've had about 100,000 students around the world up till today, I have to tell you that as a professor, you have a much more impact on human beings than a medical doctor, because you give them a tool they are going to use for the whole career. They are going to possibly support their family based on that. They are going to find self-actualization and fulfill their own wants and desires if you give them this tool. So as a professor, I find that I could change a little bit of the world, definitely change the life of the students that I teach. So the question is whether I wanted to be always a professor. I'm not sure, but I always wanted to make a difference. And as I said, I found that being a professor is possibly one way to indeed change somewhat.
Did you always believe you can be a professor?
No. And along these lines, my first lecture that I had in the United States as a younger doctoral student, I remember I entered the room and I basically introduced myself. My name is Ehud Menipaz and I'm going to teach you such and such, whatever. I still remember that concurrent with my lecture, there were two other lecturers born in the United States, spoke perfect English, had perfect Anglo-Saxon names, and they taught the same course as mine at the same time slot that was my lecture. And when I started to talk, one by one, the students basically left the room, left the lecture hall. I was looking at the lecture hall. I left by the end of the first lecture, I think, with possibly 10 students in the room. At which point, I went back to my supervisor and I said, his name was Professor Sam Mantell from Harvard University. And I said, Professor Mantell, I'm very sorry. I think this is the day where I'm going to end my academic career. I'd like to resign from the doctoral program and I'm going to go back home. And I went home and I sat with my wife and I said to her, okay, let's consider some other profession, possibly a government bureaucrat, whatever. And my wife said, no, I think you should try and show up for the next lecture. Just tell them what you know. Eventually, they look beyond the name and the funny accent, and then find a way to learn from you because you have something to teach them. And so it took me some time to recover from this initial shock, I can tell you. But since then, I was lecturing around the world, and I appeared in different TV networks, including CGTN, China Global TV Network, and the Korean network, and India network, et cetera, et cetera. I found today very interesting to look back at an academic career of about 60 years. and say to myself, I'm an academic and professor despite myself. And and I had to overcome this, what I believe is mediocre initial starting points. And I'm very proud that I've done it, obviously. But no, it was not very obvious to me on then as to my career path. But there are lessons to be learned from what I told you. The first lesson I teach my children and my grandchildren and my students as well, I say, listen, guys, you don't have necessarily to be a genius in order to be successful in what you do, but you have to be tenacious. You have to be focused. You have to be possibly average from the starting point, but you hone your skills and insist on it, and eventually you succeed. Also, in the process, be ready to give up on one of three dimensions or three things: friendship, family, and or health, if you want to be really successful. But this is my point of view.
We're excited to be collaborating with the Israeli website CTech, owned by Kalkalist, Israel's leading business newspaper. CTech is the gateway of the Israeli high tech to the tech world and vice versa. If you're not already a regular reader, we strongly recommend that you check out kalkalistech.com, C-A-L-C-A-L-I-S-T-E-C-H.com, to stay up to date on all high-impact stories from the Israeli tech scene.
Your wife was very dominant and helpful here. And I'm trying to understand, at that point in your career, what was in your toolkit that enabled her to know so clearly that you have so much to teach? At what stage was this?
Yeah, well, that was fairly early. We were then a young couple with one child. I think it was 2 years old. You have to ask her, what did she see in me that has this potential? I think she would be able to explain it to you better. But since she knew me, since she was 14, I was 16 at the time when we met. She was 14. She had 6 or 7 years with me before she knew possibly exactly my potential. And I have to tell you that we're still married after, 56 years. And it's a good question to ask her if you ever come to meet her and ask her. I'm not sure whether I can answer that.
Yeah, but I can give you a context, Noah. So let's talk about context. This was after you were in the military in a few wars, okay? And I'm the age is 20-something, early 20s, and you decide to leave Israel after those wars to study in Cincinnati and be a professor, okay? And you talk, this is first-stage immigrant. And your choices at the end, the documents you can have for a career or do or any change, you know, it's really hard to change a career once you're there. So let me ask you a direct question. How much is the lack of choice, which is something that, you know, this generation has too many choices. So the lack of choice made you persistent enough, okay, or motivated, like that is what you have to do. And how much did that contribute to it? Because, you know, like it's either military war or, you know, stay there, be a professor and whatever, you know, what other choices were there?
So I said, you're asking me good questions because one way to look at that is indeed fairly early on and my military experience as a young officer with the Armored Corps and being exposed to really the horrors of war made me understand that one should really be very focused and part of it, creating a family, making kids, quote unquote, getting a profession, find your destiny. There's not too much time in the world, you know. I think it's a phenomenon. I think people that have been to the military and exposed to wars become, obviously, if they're successful and they come back from the wars, they become very focused. They understand the meaning of life, possibly. They understand that every day you're alive is precious and you should do something credible, important, relevant to your life every minute. So I think that you're right. This contributed to the advancement, fairly advancement in my understanding of what I like to do in life. Let me talk about these days, though, because many of my students today, quote unquote, suffer from this great era where we are. In other words, they have all these great options. The world is flat, as somebody said, and in many respects, you can choose the time, the place, the country, the language that you'd like to be in or with. And I think that that makes life more challenging, more difficult. I think they, in the old days when you had not too many options, maybe it was easier in a sense. But let me tell you something. I think eventually it is up to the individual to find its own route, its own map. It is more difficult today. Maybe you are better people because of that, because you've got so many options from which you have to choose. So maybe you are a better generation than us because we had less opportunities, less options. So maybe there is a tip for life then. I think you have to indeed look inside and find out what you are capable to do. Be very honest about your skill set. Be very honest about your character. And I think maybe also about your support group, your immediate family and friends. So you can choose indeed the path you seem to think is good for you. Or, there's maybe I can also give you another thing. I think today's skills include some of the old skills, which are maybe now more important than in other generations. Networking is very important, so very important, and in this day and age, for sure. Finding your destination career-wise is important. Being ready to change. Don't be fixed on one path. Being able to check yourself every 2-3 years. And if you're not very successful or not very happy where you are, don't be too shy to make a change, you know. So be flexible enough in your career. I think this is some of the insights I can give you. And wake up at night. You are allowed to wake up at night and make notes to yourself as to, wait, I've got this great idea. And don't shy away from trying it.
I think this is fascinating. And I happen to know your son for, I think it's probably almost 20 years now. And I know that Renan has this mindset of nothing is impossible. And I think in many ways you've shaped him, and I'm pretty much, although very humbly, I'm also hearing it from you, and more than I'm hearing it from you, I'm hearing it, quote unquote, from your accomplishments, because you sort of threw that in, but it's not casual that you've worked with the president of Russia and United States presidents and some of the wealthiest people in the world, and I'm thinking to myself, like, even just the fact that you're able to work both with the government of Russia and the United States, that's not trivial. Like, most people would be, there are so many moats around that, and especially between those countries, and yet they both work with you. And just in general, your involvement, and you have arms all over the place, and you're truly, you know, that conversation, you know, with the blue car seats and the white car, it seems like you drove off with that, and you actually are making an impact. And my question here is, how do you evolve into that mindset? I know that you're the son of one of the largest entrepreneurs in Israel, who founded Awesome. And how much has that shaped you? Like, what is the secret ingredient here?
Okay, I'm a grandson of the founder of Awesome, a good man who got some prize from the government of Israel for being an excellent industrialist. And I give him lots of credit for fashioning what I believe is a very successful family trait. So I'm going to pick up on some things here. Here's a legacy that I had to grow with. It is an interesting story. I think maybe first time told to the world, so to speak. by the end of World War One, when General Allenby took over the Holy Land, my grandfather was a resident of Hebron and had a license to produce soda water. And when General Allenby created its camp, his camp in Jerusalem, he rode with his donkey from Hebron to Jerusalem. And he asked the guy at the gate of the camp whether they need some bottles of soda water. And the guy at the gate said, wait a minute, let me ask my commander. And he came back to the gate and he said to my grandfather, his name was Eliyahu, said, no, we don't need soda water. However, we need some basic food stuff. My grandfather said, what kind of basic food stuff? And the man said, the commander said, something like pasta. So Eliyahu rode back to Hebron on his donkey and asked my grandmother, Rachel, Rachel, can you make some pasta, please? Do you know how to make pasta? And she said, yeah, I think so. She made a bag of pasta. The next day, he rode with his donkey back to Jerusalem, and he sold this bag of pasta to the British army. And they said, you know what, next day, please come with two bags of pasta. So he rode back to Hebron, and the next day, obviously, he brought two bags of pasta. And it became a fairly, you know, challenging thing. And he decided he needs to have a machine for pasta. Well, he didn't know nothing about pasta, but he heard that in Italy, they make pretty good pasta. So he took a ship from Jaffa, the old port in Jaffa, to Italy. And he bought a used pasta machine. And he brought it back to Jaffa. And he pushed it up with a horse to Jerusalem. And then put it in the basement of his house. And he started to produce pasta in a more industrial scale. And then when it became quite a large business, he built up an industrial park in Jerusalem called Tel Arza, Ten Fingers, by himself. And in Tel Arza put the first site of what will be later on become Osem, the largest food factory in Israel. Make a long story short, this man with no schooling, no academic degrees, but it is wit, energy, and resolution decided he can do it. And until today, I remember the small bag he used to go with, out of which he managed thousands and thousands of employees producing pasta and other foodstuff. And as busy as he was, and that's another trait I learned from him, he had two things. I was sitting in the board of directors meeting every Sunday afternoon as a young kid, just listening to him running this business. And I remember two things about that. First of all, every week on Sunday, he'll be able to instruct the people, especially the truck drivers that are distributing the merchandise, about the week's Torah portion, which is relevant to what they have to do this week. I could never understand it. How to define in the Old Testament anything which is relevant to what they have to do today in order to be successful in their business. The other thing that I found, that as much as he was busy, he never forgets times like birthdays of his employees, names of employees. The empathy he showed for the people he met, and people who worked with him. Till today, when I roam the streets and somebody knows that he's my grandfather, they still say, we remember his good heart and moral conduct. And I think that was, you know, possibly one of the things that possibly impact me the most. Apart from his obviously very good business decisions, including having the getting Nestle, the large global Nestle Corporation, into Osem as a partner, and the rest is history, or putting together a food lab, which is by Nestle, is the best snack food lab in the world. And this food lab is based in Sderot, because Eliyahu was a Zionist, and he believed that he should help out the periphery. So there are all kinds of other things. So here's one man that definitely shaped some of my, I believe, some of the things I believe in. Yeah.
Is it okay if we divert a second? Because there is a question that's suddenly burning for me. And I think many of our listeners, I'll say it this way. I think many of our listeners are in pain these days because of everything that's happening around the world and all these voices that we're hearing against people who are Jewish. And suddenly, I think many people, me included, are feeling like if we felt like we're part of a global village, then suddenly we do not know what we're part of anymore. And I think you have this lens that you're looking through, and I'm sort of sensing like you're seeing this as a sort of, you know, hit in the wing. And I'm wondering if I'm correct here, and what's your, you know, what your take is on everything that's going on, and how our people who are Jewish are able to fulfill themselves and make an impact on the world in days where it feels like the whole world is against us.
Okay, I'll start with what I believe is a very important insight. As you know, our family came to this part of the world about 140, 150 years ago. The last stop before entering the Holy Land was Beirut, Lebanon. And they didn't expect the government to help in any way, shape, or form, but they basically created their own homes, their own stead. They were basically farmers, Jewish, religious, Zionist people. They founded many of the settlements in the upper Galilee. After so many wars, they are still there. And I believe that in that sense, patience, tenacity is very important. And believe that if you sustain yourself, eventually people will recognize your contribution to the world. But let me go beyond that for a second. As you know, I am the chairman of the Board of Governors of the National Association of Engineers and Architects in Israel. People that fall under this category, it's about 400,000, 500,000 or so. And I have an opportunity to talk to my counterparts, among them the chairman of the comparable Chinese Association of Engineers and Scientists. The number of members they have is about 100 million. And I talk to this man on a regular basis for the last 10 years or so. I also do ventures with this particular body. We've created together the World Association of Science Literacy under the auspices of the United Nations, President Xi of China, and 30 countries. I believe each one of us in their own way should use these professional, personal relationships in order to basically show the world that we have a major contribution to make. As a nation, right now under distress, if we consider this nation as an experiment, it's a great experiment where you get all the Jewish people around the world congregate in one place and run their own state, independent state, a vibrant democracy, very good in science, very good in art, very good in what I like to call advanced technology, and I won't go into details of medical technology, agricultural technology, cyber technology, etc. Even if it's just an experiment, it's a very successful experiment. And if I would be really concerned about the world future, like climate change, I'd say, let's keep this experiment. This group of people of about 10 million have something to contribute to the world. When I talk to the Chinese, they know full well who are the Nobelists of the world in physics and chemistry, etc. And they know most of them, I think about 30%, are Jewish. We're only 0.01% of the world population, but we command about 30% of the Nobel Prizes that were conferred upon scientists. Actually, I'm fortunate because a cousin of my mother is a Nobelist, Nobel Prize laureate in physics. He got his Nobel Prize for something which is the technology at the basis of the CERN, C-E-R-N, the largest particle accelerator in the world, in the border between Switzerland and France. He also, based on his IP, they use it in order to help out develop at the time MRI technology. Also something about space and also something about earthquakes. So what I'm saying is, as a group of people, we have lots to contribute. So as I say to myself, if somebody is really concerned about the future of the world, I say, keep this experiment going. Nourish it. Protect it. I know that in the Old Testament, we're supposed to be an enlightenment to the world. We're supposed to lead the way in many respects on a moral sense, not necessarily only technology. And I think in that sense, anybody who is really concerned about, as I said, the world future should keep this experiment going. Now, I go beyond politics because I'm no politician, but I can tell you that when this terrible massacre on October 7th happened, the week after that, I've already decided to help out, and I'm not that much of an expert in commando work, so I cannot really get those poor hostages back home. But I use my personal international relationships, and I've connected directly with the global executive body of the International Red Cross, and I've pushed all the way about providing medical supplies and medicine to those hostages. I'm not sure how much of that has arrived with the hostages, and the reports we get is not reliable at all. I also used some Muslim members of parliament of a third country to help me out in that as well. So what I'm saying is I don't have a solution to this big problem you just presented me with, Noah. But I think that if each one of us, and there are many like me, if each one of us would use the personal, professional relationships in order to make the point I just made, that we have something to contribute to the world, that we are indeed the good guys in this story, and we do vie for peace, a real peace between us and our neighbors, all of them, I think eventually things would turn for the better. So I'm not sure whether I answered all your questions about that or the question, but that's my contribution.
No, thank you. It's fascinating. With respect to the way that you grew up, how much were you encouraged to do your own thing versus, you know, to go and find a stable job?
Okay. I have to tell you, again, I'd love to give credit to everybody, so I'm going to give a great credit to my parents. My father, who was a great industrialist, an officer and a gentleman, with an integrity, you know, which is really an amazing trait of his. And my mother, who was an educator, not one of those educators that come to school, do the job and go back. One of those educators that are like 24/7 educators, you know. She cannot sleep at night if she has some assignment to give to the kids tomorrow or prepare some end of the year event. So I give them credit for, you know, telling me, yeah, you can do it. And if you need some help, we'll help you. But basically, do your thing. I remember it from a very early age as a member of a youth movement. You know, I was encouraged to leave the house, go camping, go to these different courses you have to give or get. In other words, be involved with the community. I remember doing stuff that usually, I guess, people my age would not do, but I've done it anyway. I won't go into detail, but I can tell you that I did manage to tour the country inside out on my own or with my friends in a very early age, sometimes without the permission of my parents, which was terrible. But I'll share with you an interesting story. I believe one of those times, I think I was made a very good educator because I got good education from my parents, not by talking, but by doing. And here is my point. In one of those ventures, I took two of my friends and we disappeared from home for 3 days, touring the country. There were no cellular phones and I didn't report back to home. And when I came home, obviously it was terrible. My parents were really worried about where I was. And my mother sent my father to deal with me. So he came to me and he looked at me long and hard. And then he said something to the point, "I'm very disappointed with you." Turned around and went away. And I said to myself, "This is terrible." I wanted him to slap me on the face. I wanted him to hit me so hard, because by that I know that I've paid my dues and I got my punishment and I'm done. But the moment he said, "I'm disappointed with you," think about what it does to a kid. It's a lesson I never forget. Possibly the best lesson in education, you know. Don't do what you instinctively would like to do as a parent. Think about punishment that will leave an impact. Certainly left an impact on me.
And do you feel that your career course, I'm talking more about the early stages, was he proud? Because now it's an easy answer. If you know, seeing you now, I'm sure he would be super proud. But when you started out, was he worried? Was this like going off into the wild like you did without telling him, you know, going off and doing your own thing, you know, professionally? Or was he proud and trusting you and supporting you?
No, I think in that sense, he was really supportive. I think he basically let me do what I thought was right. Mind you, I wanted to please the parents, as I guess many kids possibly would like to. But I have to tell you that positive feedback, I believe in. I honestly believe that kids in their own way find a way, but they need to have this positive feedback. I'm not sure negative feedback works as well. Possibly it has to do also with the mentality of the kid, but basically positive feedback is very important. Let me share with you possibly, Noah, two other instances which I believe helped me out in my career invariably. Many times I've done things for the first time and nobody taught me how to do it. And I have to tell you the story of I've written and edited 27 books throughout my career, but I'd like to tell you about the first book, if I may. I've worked out a first book which was really very interesting. It was the first of its kind, written by an Israeli academic. And I put it together, and then I decided that the book should be published by the best publisher in the world. So I bought a ticket, which was at the time very expensive for me, to New York. I landed in New York, and I marched into the best publisher I knew on 1221 Avenue of the Americas in Manhattan. And I asked the security man to let me in, and he said, "Do you have an appointment with the editor?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you cannot come in." I said, "Listen, I have no money. I have only 2 days reservations for the hotel, and I'm from out of town. Please let me in." Well, I guess I looked poor enough, and I begged him enough. So he sent me up. He said, "Fine, just wait for the editor, see what happens." I met with the editor coming out, left him with the manuscript, and flew out. Soon enough, I got a letter that says, "We consulted with the best people in your discipline, and we decided not to publish your book. Very sorry, and we wish you success going forward." At the time, we had a very small kid, new kid, and I said to my wife, her name is Esther, I said, "Esther, very sorry, I'm going to leave you for a couple of days." I bought another ticket to New York. I flew in. I rented a car this time, and I went across the Hudson River, and I went to Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. This is where the biggest competitor for the publisher I met the first time around was based. The name was Prentice Hall, very credible academic publisher. I went to Prentice Hall, the same thing with a security person. met with Dennis Hogan, the editor. I said, listen, your competitor across the river just turned down the manuscript. Please consider that for publication. And I flew out. Sure enough, 2-3 weeks later, I get a letter from Pentisol saying, Professor Menipaz will be very pleased to publish your book. We'll distribute it in 5 different continents. The rest is history.
Why did you tell them that they turned you down? How was that an advantage? Like, how is that part of the pitch?
I'm not sure whether it was an advantage, but possibly it made them aware of the fact that I would not be, if they would turn me down, I'll go to the third best publisher. In other words, even the product, I think it's a great product. And believing in yourself and believing in the product is part of, I think, the secret to success. Give you another story, which I think is one day when I have time to write my own book, I'll tell this story. Goes back a while. I'm a senior partner with Ernst & Young International, and I'm called by George Soros to go into then the former Soviet Union countries and look after targets for acquisition, because the whole thing of privatization was on the agenda at the time. I flew to Europe, got a car with a translator and a driver, and roam around Europe in former communist countries. And I remember marching into the prime minister's office of Hungary, saying I was sent by George Soros to scout for some acquisition targets. And the prime minister said, wait a minute, before you do that, I have a small request, please. Here's a one-pager, and this is our instructions for privatization. This is the new codex for privatization. What I'd like you to do before you mount on finding acquisitions is to develop the book of the law that would govern our privatization process. Sure enough, I've done that. And then I went into search for acquisition targets, came back to George Soros, and I said, here's the thing, and this is what you're supposed to do with it. And he said, oh, that's just fascinating work, Professor Menipaz. I don't have more time now. Could you join me? I'd like to take my limousine back to the airport now. Could you join me, please? So I joined George Soros, going with the limousine to the airport. As we go with the limousine, he turns to me and he said, Professor Menipaz, I'd like you to become my partner. I said, Mr. Soros, I'm very sorry. My financial means cannot make me a partner of yours. And he said to me, Professor Menipaz, do you have a quarter in your pocket? And I said, yeah, I have a quarter. He said, put it in the on the armrest. As you know, in the limousine, there's an armrest between the two seats. So I put the quarter on the armrest. He reaches to his pocket and he takes the quarter and he puts it on the armrest. And he says, okay, Professor Menipaz, now we are partners. Any funds we need beyond that for acquisition targets, I'm going to get from the Bank for Reconstruction and Development, his own bank in Europe. Well, there is only one caveat to our partnership. I said, what is it? He said, well, because I like boots on the ground, I'd like you to move with your family for several years to Budapest, Hungary. I said, wait a minute. I have a partner here, my wife. I have to check with her. He said, fine, 24 hours. You got 24 hours. So I went back to my wife and I said, listen, I can become a billionaire possibly one day. This is our chance. One caveat, we need to move to Budapest with the kids for several years. And she said those immemorial words over my dead body. Her father is from Hungary and he still remembers Budapest as being a terrible place for the Jews by the end of World War II. I couldn't do it to her or to my father-in-law. So next day, I reached to George Soros and I said, Mr. Soros, I really appreciate the opportunity, but I'm going to basically let it go because I'm not ready to move to Budapest. And he said, well, that's too bad, my friend. And by that, possibly I lost my chance to become a billionaire.
Did he give you back the quarter?
I don't remember anymore.
Too bad. Yeah. What would you say your superpower is?
My superpower?
Yeah.
Jeez. Okay, fine. I give you two of them, I think. One of them is my kids and grandkids. I think the family is a superpower of mine. I give them credit. Actually, I'm a groupie of one man in many respects. Because some of the things he does and the way he does it, for me at least, is amazing. So I'm not going to talk about all his traits, but I find there's a great mix between what I believe is a great mind and a great heart.
I was going to say heart. I had to interrupt and say also heart.
It's so, but as I said, I'm a groupie of my family. I'm a groupie of Onen. I'm a groupie of my family. There's another superpower, which I think is also key to many things I've done in my life, and this is demystification. I totally believe in the fact that many times, if you manage to demystify, it could be processes, it could be products, it could be organizations, technologies. It gives you a tool which many people do not have. Now, to demystify is not easy sometimes, but if you manage to do it, it gives you what I believe is a great superpower.
I'm speechless also because I grew up on these stories, but also because I think listeners should understand something about the demystification. Growing up in a house where you have a dad of a professor, there's two types of characteristics that can come up. You can either see the unachievable or you can see the achievable. And one of the great traits of the demystification that Professor Ehud Menipaz is talking about is to understand that at the end of the day, everything is people. People are normal. Human beings are human beings. And there's no, you know, we have real life superpowers and we're talking about superpowers. But at the end of the day, that is exactly the podcast. There's real life characteristics that are amazing. Everybody has at least one trait. Demystification means that anything complex or great or any hero or celebrity that you see at the end of the day has a very normal story. And one of the traits that I grew up with is also hearing incredible stories. But as you hear in this podcast, they're also day-to-day stories without no elements of, you know, wonders and tricks and magics. But it's a lot of persistent, a lot of, you know, courage, and a lot of just, you know,
challenges
and getting better and, you know, starting off in that, you know, white car and just doing, you know, everything you can just to get better every day. My dad, Professor Menipaz, also called himself average, but maximizing his potential, which is something very important to understand, because at the end of the day, also, we may not be average in some aspects. We may be talented in the other, but at the end of the day, we're all average, and maximizing the potential is part of that. So demystification definitely is superpower. And Professor, what would be your weakness?
I guess it's the same thing. but no, maybe I'll go beyond it. I think my weakness possibly is an endless sense of curiosity. I'm really challenged every day by something which really gets my attention, and it takes effort to keep on focusing because you've got so many opportunities, so many things you can do. So curiosity, in a way, is a weakness. I'm also fairly, I don't like controversies. Even when I don't agree with something, usually the way I convey is in a very mild way. Some people are confused. You know, I'm very soft-spoken, but very determined, and it should not be confused. So I think maybe the weakness, as I said before, my strength, but specifically curiosity is one of them, and the fact that I stay away from controversy, and if I don't agree with something, I would challenge it, but I would not go into controversy. I would not. I would shy away from controversy. Yes.
And it's a living and breathing evidence that it's very possible to just navigate with your own, you know,
with your own mindset and avoiding controversy and still winning.
Yeah, but maybe could have been easier. Like on the weakness side, things that you can avoid because it's not important. But you know, but definitely it's that. And Professor, for the hundreds of thousands of students that went through you, you can find Ehud Menipaz in any LinkedIn. Also, his books are online, and I'm looking forward to the book that we're going to write together. I think this is a good place to talk about it and just say, you know, I'm looking forward for that. And I thank you so much for your time.
Yeah. And I want to say thank you for your son. And thank you for the great impact that you're making. I wish you many more years of fulfilling yourself and contributing to the world and to keep inspiring all of us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Noah. Thank you, Onen. It was really a pleasure talking to you. I hope many people will really pick up on what you do for the world. I'm also familiar with the fact that you are very frequently broadcasted, very successful podcast indeed. So great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all for today's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to our podcast so you never miss an episode. Also, if you have a moment, we would really appreciate it if you could rate and review our podcast on the platform you're listening to. This will help others find our show. And as always, if you know anyone who you think would enjoy our podcast, please share it with them. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back as usual on the first of the month.
Real. Live.
Superpowers.
Live.
Superpowers.